So I don't know if they're made for that. I'm going to put it on this pocket where the fabric is stronger. This is actually going to be the most interesting of these three lectures for me, because I feel like I've set things up with the previous two lectures. I've talked to you about some experimental methods that we use, and I've talked to you about some results that we have found in the last two lectures. But now I want to talk about the conceptual significance of those results, not just for understanding autism, but actually for understanding humanity in general. So the title I've chosen reflects that theme of using autism to understand humanity in general, draws in some experience from neurophysiology, some experience from psychology, and some experience from literary criticism, all of which turn out to be highly relevant. So it may be somewhat self-serving, given that my own background is in computer science and English literature, and secondarily a PhD in neuroscience. But I think, from my point of view anyway, it all comes together and tells us something about the process of symbolic representation. And that's what I hope to convince you of. Okay, just to pick up where we left off during the last lecture. Now, how many people, it's quite all right, but how many people were not here during the last lecture? Just so that I can get a set. Okay, so few people. All right, so last lecture, we talked about autism as a condition in which there is a difficulty coordinating cognitive abilities. So individual cognitive abilities may be intact, but it's the bringing those abilities together flexibly and rapidly to solve novel problems that really seems the part that's impaired. Now, that connectivity of cognitive processes, that flexibility of cognitive processes, is reflected in neurophysiology. And so this is a picture that I showed last time, where we've asked people to solve a visual attention task. And we see that the people without autism solve it using a distributed array of brain regions. So different parts of the brain in parietal cortex, frontal cortex, temporal cortex, they all come together constitute of themselves a network for information processing. That network comes into existence when the problem is presented, it operates, and then it dissolves back into this general network of brain regions when the problem has been solved. In contrast, people with autism, if we ask them to solve the same problem, especially if we ask them to solve it rapidly, so they don't have a lot of time to expend the effort to bring together this network of cortical processes, they tend to solve it just by activating a region of the brain that processes visual information. So these people are operating at a high level of abstraction. They're using symbols, they're using categories, and they are perceiving the objects in front of them as instances of categories that they know. These people are using iconic, veridical, not symbolic representation. They are seeing things as they are rather than things as instances of categories. And we can read that not only from their behavior, but actually, as I hope this slide illustrates, even from the neurophysiology that they display when they're solving a visual attention task. Now, there are advantages and disadvantages to categories. One great advantage, of course, is that categories are what allow us as finite beings to represent and to manipulate an infinite perceptual world. We can reduce this chaos of a sensorium into manageable instances of categories. We can reduce our daily interactions into instances of social scripts, which is a form of categorization. And we can project these generalities onto new instances that we experience. We then replace those instances, those actual sensations, with instances of our general categories. In some sense, the autistic mode of perception is the truer mode. It's less powerful in a way, because when we're using categories, when we're using abstractions and symbols, we can manipulate entire classes of objects using just a single thought. Whereas the person with autism, if they want to manipulate 1,000 objects, they must think 1,000 thoughts. So this mode of veridical and iconic representation imposes a huge cognitive load on the person with autism. They have to do 1,000 times, perhaps, the cognitive work that we do with a single symbol. However, and this is a key point, if they are successful, if they rise to the challenge of that cognitive load, then they achieve a much, much deeper understanding of the world around them than the rest of us do, because the rest of us have falsified the world around us. To give the same example that I gave last time for the benefit of people who are not here, okay, half an hour from now, when we all walk out of this room, we're going to remember that there was a conference table, we're going to remember that there were some chairs, some windows. Maybe we're going to remember there were air conditioners on the wall. We are not, all of us, going to remember that there were, until now when I tell you about it and point it out, we're not all of us going to remember that there were 3 segments to the table. We are not all of us going to remember how many chairs there were, how many people in the room, how many panes on the windows. Because those all are veridical detail that is unimportant to the tasks that we may be faced with in the future when we remember a setting like this. So processes of memory move from iconic to symbolic representations. They consolidate veridical percepts and re-present them as instances of categories. The person with autism who walks into this room will do a huge amount of cognitive work, and when they walk out of the room, many of them will be able to draw a picture representing exactly the number of panes in the windows, the number of chairs around the table, etc. So if they can rise to the challenge of that increased cognitive load, then they achieve a much, much richer and greater fidelity representation of the world around them. Autism has been framed as what Jutta Frith and Francesca Happe called weak central coherence. They describe this phenomenon of central coherence as the drive to unify the perceptual and cognitive world, to change detail into context, to change individual object into scene, and in general, to change the trees, as it were, into the forest. What Frith and Happe term level of construal in their rhetoric about autism is exactly what social psychologist Jakob Troppe terms level of construal in his studies of normative perception and cognition. Now, Frith and Happe have a different rhetorical background, a different terminology, because they are reading and writing the autism research literature. Troppe is reading and writing the social psychology literature. And these things, historically, have been quite separate. But my claim is that these two terms and these two authors, or groups of authors, are talking about exactly the same thing. If you examine their definitions, Frith and Happe's central coherence maps exactly onto Troppe's level of construal. Troppe does experiments in normal undergraduates, whereas Frith and Happe do experiments on people with autism spectrum conditions. Trapet's work on normal undergraduates is interesting because it extends a relationship that seems to exist between level of construal and the symptoms of autism. And it seems perhaps to be a route towards unifying those symptoms of autism. Now, I told you last time that the symptoms of autism fall into three categories: difficulty with social interaction, difficulty with communication, and a tendency to engage in restricted and repetitive interests and behaviors. The question that autism research has been presented with for the past several decades is, these all describe pieces of the autistic syndrome, but how do you unify all of those domains? Clearly they overlap a bit. For example, communicative difficulty can overlap with restricted and repetitive behaviors if a child's language output is devoted only to non-communicative echoing of television adverts and this sort of thing, right? That's a repetitive behavior that impacts communication. And also, difficulties with communication. For example, difficulty jumping in to the rapid fire flow of social conversation can affect social function, of course. So these things overlap, but a general unification of them has been elusive. Repetitive behaviors involve even very simple, very basic, concrete motor actions. Not elaborate scripted rituals, but just things like rocking, hand flapping, this sort of thing. How do you unify that with social dysfunction? It's been a difficult question for autism research. A claim that I want to make is that Trapet's view of level of construal / central coherence is a way to unify those three separate symptom domains in autism. Trapet has studied what he terms psychological distance. And again, this is not in autism or in any clinical population, but just in normal undergraduates. And he finds that level of construal interacts with psychological distance. So, he finds that when you prime a person for a particular level of construal, when you say to them, okay, I want you to look at this picture and notice the forest rather than the trees. Or I want you to look at, we don't have a marker, do we? Oh, we do. Dry erase, yes. Or I want you to look at this picture and notice the large letter. Now, most people much, much more readily notice the small letter here, the N, rather than the large letter, the S. Trapet finds that if you prime them for selecting the large stimulus rather than the small stimuli of, that constitute it, and then you have these people write out narratives about social interactions, they will tend, after being primed for the global rather than the local level, to write out narratives that describe much more distant, more formal social relations rather than socially close everyday friendships. You will find also that they are much more primed to describe temporally distant events, events that happened a long time ago or that will happen far in the future versus events that are going on right now. Hypothetical distance, too, is altered and interacts with level of construal. If you prime a person to notice, again, the big letter, the high level of construal, then they will be much better at describing events that are hypothetical, that might or might not take place, versus the concreteness of events that definitely will take place. And vice versa, if you prime a person on psychological distance, if you tell them that certain event will happen versus might happen. Or if you tell them that a person is an important dignitary to be respected versus a friend that you're about to have lunch with, you will find the corresponding effects of that hypothetical or social distance exerted on reaction times to small or large letters in this level of construal task. So there's an interaction between the level of construal task, this is called the Navon task, and priming for spatial, social, temporal, or hypothetical distance. So there's a question then as to how this relates possibly to autism. How might this non-social, very perceptual phenomenon of level of construal relate to autism's social symptoms, and in particular to the very oft-cited difficulty in autism of theory of mind? Well, here are some examples of experiments done with normal undergraduates on level of construal. You have a word denoting either social distance or social proximity, and you present that word either at a distant spatial perspective or a nearby spatial perspective. Now, one of these pictures, actually both of these pictures now are incongruent, right? We have them, a distant social term, presented at a close-up spatial perspective, and we have us, a proximal social term, presented at a distant spatial perspective. When this experiment is done, we find that people's reaction times to identifying the word actually lengthen when the presentation of the word and the presentation of the social perspective are incongruent to each other, when they don't match. A further example. Here's some items from the Gestalt completion test. So what you need to do here is to translate low construal details into a high construal complete picture. You need to put all of these separate details together, and out pops, I hope you can see it, a picture of a child, right? Here's the face, shoulders, etc. So this process of recognizing these pictures depends upon translation from low to high level of construal. And it turns out that when you prime subjects by telling them that these are examples from a task that you're going to do far in the future, or these are examples from a task that we might have you do, but not necessarily will have you do, it turns out that they get better at constructing that high construal image because they have been primed to adopt a psychologically distant perspective. Okay. Now, relating all of this to autism, any questions so far on what level of construal is and how it relates to psychological distance? We good? Okay. Level of construal and repetitive behaviors. If level of construal is going to explain a lot about autism, then we have to be able to relate it to the three symptom domains of autism: repetitive behaviors, social dysfunction, communicative dysfunction. Let's start with repetitive behaviors. Here's my image of relating repetitive behaviors in autism to the construction of perceptual representations. Imagine that your life is a film, and it's being projected in some Cartesian cinema. So everything that you experience is on the big screen in the Cartesian cinema. Except there's a problem. How many times have you been to a film that is projected by students on campus, right? And they're kind of just learning? Yeah. The Cartesian cinema is a little like that. It's run by a somewhat less than competent projectionist. And as a result, at any given time, you can only see one channel of information, or only experience one channel of information from the film. Maybe you get picture without sound, Maybe you get sound without picture. Or maybe the projectionist gets the aperture wrong, so you can only see a tiny corner of the frame at a certain time. Whatever it is, you have only one channel to work with. You have only part of the film. And so it's very, very difficult to understand this film. Now, if you want to understand it, and you have ad libitum access to the cinema, and the projectionist is a friend of yours who doesn't mind spending extra time, what might you ask the projectionist to do? If you want to understand the film, you didn't understand it the first time through. Yeah, play it again, rewind, sure. So you do this, all right. You rewind the film, you sit through it again, you're really motivated to understand this film because everybody around you is talking about this film and you'd really like to comprehend it. You play it again, maybe you understand it a little bit more. Maybe you understand a different channel. If you can play the film again and again and again, you do two things. Number one, you have a much greater chance of understanding what is going on in the film. Number two, perhaps even more importantly, by playing the film again and again, you prevent that film from being replaced by a new, entirely different, first-run film in the Cartesian cinema. So, repetitive behaviors are, I contend, the reaction of a reasonable, rational human mind when confronted with an abnormally disconnected perceptual and cognitive environment. Okay, so we've managed, I think, to connect repetitive behaviors to this overemphasis on disconnected sensory detail, whose physiology I talked about in the last lecture. So I hope that you will accept my claim that a pathologically low level of construal can actually produce repetitive behaviors as an accommodative cognitive reaction to try to manage a disconnected world and to insert that disconnected world into recognizable routines and scripts. We're all trying to construct a narrative about our world. The only difference with people with autism is they're constrained to construct a much more concrete narrative. Okay. So we've done level of construal, we've related level of construal to repetitive behaviors. Now we have to relate it to language. Okay, most of you will recognize this quotation from Lacan's Function and Field of Speech and Language in Psychoanalysis. Lacan wrote that the symbol se manifeste d'abord comme meurtre de la chose. The symbol manifests firstly as the killing of the thing. I think nowhere but in autism do we have such a keen example of Lacan's observation. People with autism choose the converse strategy. We falsify reality by replacing it with instances of categories. They avoid falsifying reality, but the price that they pay is that they have a great difficulty and have to spend a great effort to build categories explicitly out of individual exemplars. We just blithely replace exemplars with models constructed by instantiating our categories. They don't. And so there's a trade-off. We are much better at contextual function, at narrative flow, at any kind of psychologically distant operation or abstraction you want to mention. But they have this great fidelity to the original details. Now, language, I don't think that it's any coincidence that in several major religions, the act of creation, the act of division of the universe into separate parts, into heaven and earth, into water and land, into Maya, is related to the word. The first thing that you do when you create representation, when you construct reality, is to use symbolic terms. So level of construal, I think, maps most directly onto language, because language itself, as Lacan observed, is inherently a process of distance from the object, a process of falsification. When we use language, we are substituting something for the veridical reality that we experience. Now, if you have a person with severe autism who does not speak at all, you could explain that in terms of, well, there's a disruption of frontal lobe processes that permit language to develop. And yes, that is all true. But if we look at a more general function of frontal lobe, it seems to me the function of frontal lobe is to allow this substitution of psychologically distant representations for iconic or veridical representations. That happens in the domain of language. It also happens in the domain of behavioral inhibition. Right? There's a difference between impulsively doing something right now and temporarily distancing yourself from that, getting ready to do it tomorrow, or hypothetically distancing yourself from it, getting ready possibly to perform that action. So these functions of linguistic distance, or symbolic distance, temporal distance, hypothetical distance, they're all bound up with frontal lobe function, all of which is disrupted in autism. So my claim is that it's really already been proven. I don't need to say anything about level of construal and language. I think Lacan has said it all. I have described people with autism in this domain of language and construal as human but more so. Because, again, we are all trying to narrate the world around us. That is the task that we all have. We are finite beings stuck awkwardly in a role between that of God and animal. We have the ability to contemplate the infinite, but we are mortal creatures with finite brains and finite minds. That is an extremely difficult position to be in. And it leads to all of human culture and all of human religion. People with autism, just like the rest of us, are confronted with a fractured and disrupted world of Maya, a world of detail that they somehow need to narrate and piece together and make sense of. The difference with them is that the details are so much more salient, so much more intrusive on higher construal narrative representations, that they have to do a lot more cognitive work to construct a narrative representation. The way in which people with autism tend to solve this problem is a very explicit way. They begin with the details. They effortfully, explicitly build up categories and narratives from those details. Their minds work a bit like the minds of engineers, who start with the details and build up the entire structure, thereby understanding every level and every relationship between levels, because they have explicitly modeled that relationship. In other words, people with autism who succeed at the problem of representation are bricoleurs. They piece together these collages of detail. And again, when they succeed, they achieve a much deeper understanding of the world around them than the rest of us. So this is why I describe them as human, but more so. They illustrate in a very salient way this problem of representation with which we are all confronted. Okay, level of construal and theory of mind. This is my favorite quotation from a person with autism. I think this says it all. This is back in 1994. I was a graduate student. I was a second year graduate student, so I still had time to read electronic mailing lists. And this was posted on the St. John's Autism mailing list. It's a person with autism describing the difficulty they have in seeing things from other people's point of view. And this person writes, "It's just that putting myself in someone else's shoes means that I first have to force that person out of their own shoes." Now, this person actually is talking semi-metaphorically. Well, maybe metaphor is the wrong word. Metonymically. Think about what you need to do to solve a theory of mind problem. Now, here is the prototypical test of theory of mind. Theory of mind is the ability to represent other people's beliefs as distinct from one's own beliefs and knowledge. Here's the way in which classically it is tested. This is Sally, this is Anne. Sally puts her ball in the basket, she goes away, she leaves the room. Anne picks up the ball from the basket, moves it to her box. Anne is being devious, right? She's changing things whilst Sally is out of the room. Sally comes back, and you ask the child, okay, where will Sally look for her ball? Again, for those of you who are in the last lecture, the correct answer is in the basket. somebody said the box? I don't know. So Sally is going to look in the basket because she has no idea that the ball has been moved. Now, in order to answer that question, I have to maintain separately from my own true knowledge of the ball's location my model of Sally's belief that the ball is still in the basket. There are a few things I need to do in order to answer this question correctly. I need to have that model, first of all. I need to be able to construct a model of somebody else's belief. But I also need to be able to apply that model as distinct from my own model of the true state of the world. Now, if the details comprising the true state of the world are so salient to you that they interfere and disrupt your hypothetical, remember hypothetical, psychological distance, okay? They interfere with and disrupt your hypothetical model of somebody else's belief about the world, then you may be able to model that person's other belief, but be unable to apply that model because the true details about the world are so salient to you that they rise up and interfere with your application of your model of somebody else's belief. It's just that putting myself in someone else's shoes means that I first have to force that person out of their own shoes. So this is how I think hypothetical and spatial psychological distance may relate to theory of mind disruption in autism. And if that's the case, then we've related successfully a level of construal to all three symptom domains in autism. Social dysfunction, communicative dysfunction, and restricted and repetitive behaviors. I think it's very significant that the standard diagnostic instrument for autism, called the Autism Diagnostic Interview, actually includes questions addressing every one of Tropez's examples of psychological distance. Children with autism have difficulty with hypothetical distance, difficulty with social and physical perspective taking, difficulty with temporal distance, with describing things that are going to happen next year or things that happened a year ago. They're very much dominated by things that are in front of them in the here and now and by the details that are salient to them. Okay. Level of construal and the genesis of humanity. Here's a child with autism. He's doing what every child does. And if you were in my last lecture, this is a bit of recap. This child, for him, he is zooming in on an individual detail in this picture. For him, the only thing that exists in this picture is the string. Everything else is outside the scope of his attention, because his attention is consumed with this physical detail. Now, this is a physical system. He can manipulate it. He can provide an output by shaking the string. And he can then observe the resulting input. The string moves in a particular way. He can repeat that action. The same output generates the same or a similar input. So the string is a deterministic system, which is a very comforting aspect of the world. People are not deterministic systems. They have a lot of state. How they respond to you, if you give them the same input on one particular day and on the next day, might be completely different, because it would depend what mood the person were in. They might respond happily one day and angrily the next. But the string is always the same. The string is a simple narrative about the world. And this autistic child is behaving as a scientist, exploring the world, manipulating some independent variable by shaking the string, and observing a dependent variable by observing the way in which the string moves. This is how autistic children operate, and to a certain extent, it's how all children and all people operate. We're all applying a scientific method to understand the world around us. Now, some of us do that concretely and are better at understanding physical and mechanical systems. And some of us do that more empathically and interpersonally and are better at understanding people. The therapeutic implications, I think, of this connection between autism symptoms and level of construal include possibly a backdoor therapeutic approach to autism. The standard kind of therapy for autism is, okay, they're bad at social skills, they're bad at communication. Let's try to train them on social skills. Let's try to train them on communication. Now, those are very good approaches, and I do not mean to cast aspersions on them. They're excellent, excellent things to do. But they might not be the whole picture. Let's suppose that in addition to doing those things, you try to prime an autistic child with stimuli like this, or maybe more complex examples, that got the child thinking and perceiving on a more global rather than local level. That is, a higher construal rather than a lower construal level. If Tropez's work on normative social psychology generalizes to the case of autism, then you would expect that priming the child with autism to look at the whole picture rather than a detail might affect that child's social and communicative performance and competence. So there's a therapeutic implication here. Level of construal and human cognitive diversity.
I don't know, how does it work that it seems to be the defect is in ability to generalize in some sense. So can you make them learn to generalize?
The defect is an ability to generalize, so can you make them learn to generalize? Well, my claim is that generalization is a process of creating psychological distance. And so that if we can prime them for high construal stimuli, because high construal, according to Tropez results, is related to psychological distancing, then that in itself ought to make them better, or at least more receptive, to training on generalization, noticing context, social perspective taking, making and interpreting hypothetical statements, all of these aspects that are impairments in autism. Okay. Level of construal and human cognitive diversity. How are we for time, by the way? Yeah. Okay. How many minutes do we have?
Okay. It's
4:15
right now.
Oh, yeah. There's a clock break. Okay.
It's
1 hour.
Okay.
Okay, perfect. Actually, absolutely perfect. Okay, level of control and human cognitive diversity. Now, last time I presented some slides that applied our experimental techniques not only to people with autism, but actually also to people without autism. And we found that the autism spectrum is continuous with normal human cognitive diversity. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a diagnostic distinction between autism and not autism, but it is to say that at some level, that where one places that distinction becomes more a matter of biomedical convention than a matter of absolute empirical distinction. So, to recap some of the data that I presented previously, if you look at siblings of people with autism, behaviorally, they tend to be right in between autistic and non-autistic samples. So there seems to be this continuum where people with some genetic loading for autism who have not themselves been diagnosed with autism show some autistic traits. This particular graph is a graph of performance in a distributed visual attention task. Same thing physiologically. I showed you this graph, right? Where if you look at just this panel, the red is people without autism who are unrelated to anybody with autism. The blue is people with autism. They react more slowly to this visual attention task. And the magenta is clinically unaffected siblings of people with autism who have the same time course as their autistic siblings, but a greater amplitude of response. So it seems like there's something similar going on in siblings of people with autism, and perhaps in degrees throughout the general population, something similar to what's going on in people with autism. In fact, when we relate the timing of this brain activation, and this is in a context of a non-social task of visual attention, mind you, when we relate the timing of this brain activation to measures of autistic social cognitive traits, we find that in the people with autism and in the unaffected siblings, and also slightly in the unrelated normal controls, pseudo-autistic personality traits in the social and communicative domain are related to the timing of brain activation in this non-social visual attention task. So this, I think, is some evidence for this sort of connection between raw perceptual level of construal on the one hand and social psychological distance on the other. Same thing, I showed you this slide, which is some electrophysiological responses. You have the autism group in red, you have the sibling group in green, and you have the typical group in blue, and the sibs are right smack in the middle between the control group and the autistic group. Okay, when you plot these amplitudes of brain electrical responses, and this is again in another non-social task, this is a go no-go task, as I explained last lecture. When you plot these non-social brain electrical responses versus scores on a measure of perception, social perception of emotional facial expressions, you find that there's a linear relationship. And that relationship is defined not just by the autistic sample, but also by the siblings and actually by the unrelated normal controls. There's this inverse relationship between the amplitude of that brain electrical response and the degree of social competence in inferring a person's emotional state from a picture of their eyes. Okay, further example. This is work by my graduate student Jeff Valla at Cornell. Men, but not women, with prolonged go-no-go reaction times have lesser social perceptual and social communicative capacities. So if you take a long time, if you're a man but not a woman, and if you take a long time to decide on an action in response to a stimulus, if, in other words, if you have inefficient behavioral inhibition, you find that you also are likely to have lesser social perceptual and social communicative capacities as measured by the Benton face recognition test and the autism spectrum quotient, respectively. Further example, this is my favorite one because it's a great topic of dinner conversation. Okay, so my student Jeff Valla was interested in cognitive differences between the population of women in general and the population of men in general. That's not to say, and I always have to be careful to stress this, okay? It's not to say that every man is more or less competent than every woman on a particular measure, or that every woman is more or less competent than every man on a particular measure. It's just to say that when you take the two populations and you look at their means, the means differ on some of these measures. So Jeff was interested in what drives men and women into scientific or technical careers. So he looked at Cornell undergraduates and he gave them this battery of tests that we usually give to people with autism and their relatives. And he asked the question, is it the case that scientists and engineers have greater levels of autistic personality and cognitive traits? And he found that the answer was yes, but the particular traits that male scientists and engineers and female scientists and engineers have differ. The women's pseudo-autistic cognitive trait was that they were excellent at attention to detail and a perceptual disembedding. Again, this is the ability to pick out the N here rather than the S, right? To zero in on detail and to ignore context in situations where the task calls for ignoring context. The men's pseudo-autistic personality trait was that they were rubbish at social communication. Now, I'll leave it to you to relate that general finding of a population difference to your own particular experiences in everyday life with scientists and engineers. It is not always the case that narrow attention to detail is a bad thing. It can be a very, very useful thing. And it depends upon context. So, human cognitive variation that includes individuals with great attention to detail, that includes individuals with these sorts of pseudo-autistic perceptual features, with a bias towards low level of construal, is a very useful thing. Simon Baron Cohen, my old supervisor at Cambridge, has argued that perhaps autism is maintained in the population, in other words, is not selected out by natural selection, precisely because the same genetic variations that give rise to autism, when they occur in other combinations and perhaps in smaller measure, give rise to engineers. So you wouldn't want to edit them out of the population. Well, maybe in some circumstances you would, but you know. Okay, so my point is that what we are dealing with here when we study autism is an extreme of the same factors that lead to human cognitive diversity in general. That ought to provide us with a caution, because we are on the verge of being able to artificially select for individual genetic variants. I really don't think that at a genetic level it would be possible to separate autism from human cognitive diversity. That doesn't mean that we can't cure autism. It just means that we can't cure autism by manipulating genes at a population level. What we need to do is find the people who are at risk for autism and give them the social and communicative abilities to share their unique low-construal perception of the world with the broader social community. I do think that it will be possible for us to have our cake and eat it too, as it were. In other words, to preserve the ability to notice these small details and also to communicate those small details. I think that we have an example of that in people who function as engineers or in people with Asperger syndrome who have perfectly intact communicative ability and who notice small details like this. So all of this work has come out of my lab, which is full of work of a whole lot of people. All of the scientific, empirical work that I've discussed is work of my video game programmers and my lead programmer, August Zinser, all my undergraduates, my graduate student, Jeff Valla, my collaboration with Google, my funding from Autism Speaks and the U.S. National Science Foundation. And again, because my lab members are doing all such different things and can never get together in the same photo, here's the second photo of everybody who didn't make it into the first photo. So that's everybody. Thank you very much for listening. That's it.
How do you correlate this lack of empathy among autistic children with communication and socialization? Both are impaired among autistic children. So, can you elaborate on this aspect?
How do we correlate lack of empathy with lack of communication and socialization? Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it depends how you define empathy, actually. I am not one of the people who subscribes to the view that empathy in general is impaired in autism. I think rather there are cognitive and affective aspects of empathy. And what is impaired in autism seems to me to be cognitive empathy. That impairment stems from this general impairment of rapid cognitive flexibility that I talked about in the last lecture. You will see people with autism reacting emotionally. And that is very, very evident to anybody who has spent time with people with autism. They will react emotionally not only from their own perspective, but also when good or bad things happen to people whom they like and trust. Now, that reaction might not be a rapid one. It might not be on the time scale that we expect. It might not happen during the same minute or the same hour, or even the same day. There are many, many narratives of people with autism who, you know, you'll present them with some sad news. They'll act as if it has gone in one ear and out the other. And then the next day, you'll find them crying. There's a lot of empathy that goes on in autism. It's just not, like other aspects of autistic cognition, it doesn't operate flexibly on the same time scale as we operate on. So I think that disruption in cognitive empathy in particular stems from the same processes of cognitive coordination and flexibility and perspective taking and psychological distancing that affect theory of mind.
We'll take a break for coffee.
Okay.
And then we will reassemble.